Okay, I think. Good evening. We'll make a beginning. This evening we're on letter B. So I thought, why not talk about business ethics, the sort of thing that most rabbis wouldn't remotely want to talk to their balabatim about, because as soon as you start criticizing them about their business practices, there goes your financial support for the year. But I feel in a rather privileged position, so I don't really have to worry about that too much, hopefully. Before we begin this, I just want to say two things. Number one, that the sources, I didn't mention this last week, a lot of this comes from a gentleman who's now in Israel, been in Israel for many years already, somebody called Nochum Amzel. I don't know if anyone knows him, Norman Amzel. Right, so he's a wonderful gentleman. We actually were together with him in Herzliya 3 years ago with his parents-in-law, Wael, his wife's parents. And he put out a book, must have been 25 years ago, Encyclopedia of Ethics and Morals of the Jewish Religion, or something like that. And then he put out his second volume about a year ago. So it took him 25 years to write the second book. It's unbelievable. And he was in NCSY, and he did a lot of stuff. He was way ahead of the game in so many ways. Very interesting rabbi, and certainly, if you come across him in Israel, certainly worth hearing him speak and getting to know him. He's a very, very special man. He had a seminary at one time, which didn't quite work out. He's very close to Nechama Leibowitz, as some of us were at different stages. I thank him because these sources he brings in his book are so well set out. It's already half the battle to find the sources. The font's a bit small, but I tried to increase the size as best I could. I also want to mention somebody who passed away this week who I didn't know personally, but who, when we talk about Jewish music, we talk about Shlomo Carlebach being the original. There's somebody even more original than Shlomo Carlebach, Ben Tzion Schenker. Tzion Schenker passed away this week. He was 91, 92. That voice was just so unique. I heard him daven once in Israel. The Modjes Hasidim that he represented, essentially after the war, apart from the Rebbe who got to Eretz Yisrael, but the majority of the Hasidim were killed in the war. It's revived itself. The music is just very, very special. And I heard him daven once. There's a small shtiebel in Yerushalayim, probably now a bigger shtiebel, but in those days it was very small. And it was really a great privilege to hear him. So his memory should be for a blessing. The introduction to what I'm talking about this evening, about business ethics, is something that I was really shocked. Belonging to the RCA, which is the Rabbinical Council of America, you sometimes get across your email inbox or in your email inbox certain things which are really kind of worth following up. So they sent out, must have been about 2 or 3 months ago, a link to a speech at the Aguda convention, the Agudas Yisrael, which generally speaking, if they have a convention, they usually have some serious, that's what I call the longer beards, right? The sort of serious bearded gentlemen. And they talk generally about issues of learning issues, a lot of family issues. They've now taken on the whole question of abuse in the community, and to their credit, they're trying to, sort of bring more attention to it. But one of the talks, which really I found so, not just amazing, but more to the point, so disturbing, was a talk by a lawyer. They had a lawyer at the end, very frum guy, probably somewhere in New York, and he spoke about his practice. And his practice is to defend people who have become under investigation by the government. And he particularly defends religious people. He said 10, 12 years ago this was not a problem. Today it's a big problem. And what's happening is either mostot, sort of institutions, or different groups of people who seem to think that government money is, you can just sort of name your figure and that they'll give it to you without any, what they call in Hebrew, din v'cheshbon. There's no backlash to this, and there really is. And he said he spoke about the concept of honesty and he sort of told this story, which really was unbelievable, that he was sitting with a group of very, obviously very religious guys who were talking about their particular case and were getting very upset with the lawyer because he was kind of critical of them. There's just a couple of pages there. He was critical of these guys, and his secretary was sitting there. And his secretary was listening to the way that they were criticizing him. How can you say this? And why don't you use this type of defense or whatever. You know, they were saying things to him which were so unreasonable. And the woman, who's not Jewish, she said, "Gentlemen, I'm going to stop the conversation now because I don't understand. I don't understand why you're so particular. We had to go specially to one place around the corner here to get you the food that you eat, what you want to take into your mouth, but you're absolutely not living your religious ideal when it comes to what goes out of your mouth, and certainly not in terms of what you're doing with other people's money." And she said it. And this guy at the Yigudah convention repeated the story. It was amazing. It wasn't Brafman. Brafman gave a famous speech a few years ago. He spoke in Borough Park, and he said to the Hasidish crowd there, he said, "I'm going to tell you what I do for a living, but I don't want any of you to become my clients." And that's what he introduced it. It was quite funny at the time. I guess it may not necessarily be that way anymore. It's scary. It's frightening, because what we're going to find when we talk about business ethics in Jewish life, and we're going to really do a very superficial thing because we can't really go into any of these things in great depth, but what we will find is that this is so fundamental to being Jewish, what it means in terms of the way we conduct ourselves, what we always talk about, Ben Olam L'Chaveiro, between man and man, and we always give lip service to that, but the greatest kind of Ben Olam L'Chaveiro, which is so difficult and so challenging, is clearly in the area, one of the areas, is clearly business ethics. And this is really why I want to talk about it. And as I said, you know, if it came up at an Agudah convention, then there is something to talk about. The page that you see in front of you, there are a number of sources at the beginning. This famous Gemara in Shabbat. And this Gemara in Shabbat is probably one of the scariest statements of Talmud that you'll find anywhere. The Gemara is discussing what will happen after 120 years when a person goes up to stand in front of the good Lord, and what does God ask you? What are those questions that you're going to have to face? So have a look at the first quotation in Hebrew. And again, you know, if you follow on with me, then it's easy to follow. Good evening. So it says like this, Omar Rava, B'sha'ah she'machnisim adam ledin, when a person is brought into judgment, you're put on the pedestal. Omrim lo, they say to him, presumably the angels, right? Whoever, it's not going to be on behalf of God. They're saying, Nosata v'nosata be'emunah. Did you carry out business in a faithful way? Were you honest in business? That's the first question you're going to be asked, right? It's not, did you daven three times a day with kavana, and did you have Rebbeinu Tam's tefillin and all the rest of it? No, that's not remotely in the discussion. The first question, according to the Gemara Shabbat here, page 31, did you do your business transactions in an honest fashion? Wow. Question number two, Kavat Itim Latara, is also pretty serious. Did you fix times for learning? And I've always sort of been intrigued by that particular phrase, to fix times for learning, because, you know, when you hear the kind of yeshiva model of learning, you know, as much as you can, and what is a masmid, and all these types of definitions, a person who learns a lot. The reality is, the Gemara is saying that the maybe not for the individual, outstanding individual, but for the average person, it's about fixing time for learning. It's not necessarily about learning many hours, but it's having that fixed time. I always remember in yeshiva, I think Rav Matzil Salomon told the story about a gentleman who, for 1 hour in the evening, you could not reach him. He was, I don't know, a businessman or whatever. His phone was off. Nowadays, you would say his cell phone is switched off. You couldn't get hold of him. For that 1 hour in the evening when he had his daily learning, whatever it may be, that was it. That was the fixture. Not only that he had a fixed time, but he also was unavailable to anything else. I suppose if there was a real crisis, you know, you could call him out, but that would be the only reason. As I said over here, it's not about Chalav Yisrael, and it's not going to be about the size of your tefillin. Very interesting. A few years ago, there was a wonderful restaurant. There's two restaurants like this in America. One was in Boston. I think it's still there. I think Milk Street Cafe, if you know which one. And there was one in Wall Street. And then they had the Wall Street demonstrations, and the Milk Street Cafe closed down. And before it closed down, I got lucky. I went in there. I made an appointment to see the Mashkiach. And I decided I wanted to check it out, just to see how they do it, because they were doing fleishiks and milchiks, and they were doing parav, and how they kept everything separate. It's very interesting to me, because it's part of what I do every day. And I, the thing that struck me more than anything else is the number of people who came in, and they asked just one question: is this place Chol of Yisrael? Does it have supervised kosher milk? And the answer was no, because it was an OU facility and they weren't putting themselves in that particular situation. And immediately people walked out. And it just blew my mind that, you know, this is fabulous restaurant with endless amount of choices. No Kol of Yisrael, they were out of there. And again, it's just a comment that I felt sort of so amazing. I said to the Mashgiach, you know, what's going on here? Is this really such a standard that people won't eat there because of Kol of Yisrael? And he said, yeah. He said, you know, we made it, I think maybe one of the reasons why they didn't succeed in the end. I don't know, but it's really very, very strange. Look at the second quotation here, Gemara Nida, where the Gemara talks about, again, back to business, the whole idea of becoming wise, becoming smarter. How does a person become a smarter person? Look at the second line. Maya, the end of the line. Mayase Adam Yit Asher, right? Nice question with a sort of a very practical consequence. What should a person do to become wealthy? Okay, it doesn't say invest in the stock exchange. It says, Amalehem Yarbe Bischora, he should increase his activity, his business activity. V'yisov yitim be'emunah, but do it in honest fashion. All right, again, the same phrase that we had before. Amrullah and the rabbis say, Harbe osuke v'lo yavilu. Many people tried it, didn't work. You know, it's not easy. You have to pray to God for mercy, the one who controls wealth. So basically, the idea of at least indulging in business in order to become a smarter person or to become a wealthier person, because the first part of the Gemara talks about becoming smart, is something interesting. All right, the rabbis did not see indulging in business as a negative activity, but they saw it as an activity which requires a very responsible attitude. Look at the next quotation here. So, these quotations are just so interesting. It's from Midrash Mechil to Beshalach, so it's one of the old Midrashim. V'hayosha be'inov ta'ase zemaso mata. That you should do what is yosha, what is correct. That refers to business. Melame chakomi shenose venosim be'emuna. If anyone conducts his business in an honest fashion, ruach habriyot nochem imenu, that becomes something which the people around him are very happy with him. They're very impressed by him, whichever way you want to translate it. Umalin alav ki ilu kiyem et kol haTorah kula. Wow. And it's as if you fulfilled the whole Torah. And the next comment, Ditnan, Gemara Baba Bata, right at the end of the Gemara there, Ditnan Rabbi Shmuel Omer, harotza shiit chakem, as we said before, you want to become smart, Yasuk b'dinim omenus. You should indulge and study the laws of monetary matters. She'ein lecha miktsoa b'torah yosimem. There's no greater subject which will sort of, you know, refine your mind than that. And what you do find today is certainly a lot of people are studying this, right? The Daf Yomi in the moment, they're in the middle of Baba Metzia, all the Babas. And you go through all of that stuff and you realize how incredibly pedantic and particular the rabbis were when it came to things like cheating. At the moment, pages and pages of Gemara at the moment, all about onah, about whether you take a sixth and you take less than a sixth and more than a sixth, how you calculate the sixth, all these types of things in terms of cheating in business if you're so inclined, or rather you shouldn't be so inclined. And all of that is so interesting, but again, one gets the feeling that people learn this in yeshiva, or they learn it in high school, and then they go out into the big wide world, and their attitude is, they sort of, the word I like, which you use here, I've never heard this word until I came to America, bifurcate. Bifurcation, you go that way in business, and your bon matzia is sort of left in the corner there, you know, you've gone in a different direction almost. And it's challenging. The Gemara Yevamot puts it very bluntly, Dom Rabbi Levi, next quotation, kosher, onshin shel midot yoter mi onshin shel arayot. The punishment for midot, here doesn't mean behavior, but it means measures, right? If you have weights and measures which are wrong, in other words, you're not honest in business, it's more severe than the punishment for immorality. And that again is a very shocking statement. That's also based on the whole story of the flood, etc. And I don't want to go into that now. In the Oxford Dictionary, fascinating, 1970 edition. And the only reason I know this is because I found a copy of this up in the Poconos when I was in summer camp for a number of years. They had the old Oxford Dictionary. I was told by somebody, look up the word Jew, right? Look up, and of course it says of the Hebrew nation, etc. But it has in the third or fourth definition there, the verb to Jew somebody. What is it? What was the definition? To cheat. wow, you know, I mean, I guess it came from, I don't know, from English literature, Shakespeare, whatever, and that's kind of scary. And in fact, somebody complained to the Oxford Dictionary company, I don't know what you call it, and in the 2000 edition, it came out in 2000, they took that out, right? They substituted it in 2008 with tomato for somebody. Unfortunately, we're not far away from the whole thing all over again. It's very difficult because that went right around the world and is still reverberating in so many ways. It's very hard that on the one hand, you know, here we are preaching this high moral ground, and yet we seem to let ourselves down over and over again. Except the beautiful story, and I'm sure you all know this story. A young Chabad rabbi, and I don't remember now where he was living, somewhere in the middle of America, I don't know which state, and he bought a desk. Remember this? Do you remember this story? And they found $98,000 taped to the bottom of the desk. As they say in the Hebrew, in can't do it in Yiddish, but I suppose the equivalent, we should all be so lucky. You know, you got, wow, you bought the desk and there it is. It's like cash. And his immediate reaction was, I've got to return the money to the person who I bought the desk from. They obviously put it there. And the woman, it was such a strange story. She'd forgotten, I mean, how does one forget that? She'd forgotten that she'd put $90,000 in a bag, taped it to the bottom of the desk, and then sold the desk. Unbelievable story. And it was such a tremendous Kiddush Hashem what he did. Right? And what is annoying is that he got a reward from the woman. She gave him $200. That was it. You know, give me $98,000, here's $200 in return. I mean, you know, there was a bit of an imbalance there. But I think the point was that the way that he made that automatic decision, there was not a question, you know, maybe what, you know, start sort of doing what I call this thing with the Gemara this way and that way. No! It's not my money, it's not, you know, this was a mistake. And we'll see at the end here, there's a beautiful story in the Gemara about this. And that was a Kiddush Hashem. And part of what we're going to be talking about here is the fact that business practice, business ethics, is an opportunity to make a tremendous Kiddush Hashem. There's a company that was building in London, but owned by somebody called Reichman. There were two brothers, I think, from Canada. Three brothers. And they started building in London something called Canary Wharf. It was a really a place which you wouldn't go to in your wildest dreams. It really was totally neglected. And they built their buildings which became offices, and now there's even a sort of Jewish community which is developing in that particular part of the world. Once upon a time there was a big Jewish community in that part of the world, and they all moved out. Lower East Side, and they went to the suburbs, you know, like they do everywhere else. But now they're coming back there. When it was being built, it was Margaret Thatcher at the time, and I'll never forget the picture of Margaret Thatcher going around with one of the Reichman brothers with very serious kippah, and he was explaining to her why. She asked, I hear you close at 3 o'clock on a Friday during the winter, why? And he explained to her, because, you know, our rules of Sabbath are very strict. Everybody went home on a Friday at 3 o'clock. Unbelievable. Never, you know, in England, you just don't hear of stuff like that. Maybe hear of it here, but in London, it was unique. And again, what came over from that particular project and the way that they conducted themselves was this tremendous Kiddush Hashem that came out of it. And it was all about the way that they related, I guess, not only to the workers, but also in terms of, you know, sort of putting their religious ideals into the business practice that they were following. On the second page two, we're going to come back to that towards the end. On page two, there is this famous comment from Midrash. It's actually Midrash Tanchuma about Zevulun and Yisachar. You say Yisachar and Zevulun. And this, again, is kind of an interesting development, that there was an arrangement. And in fact, the Midrash puts it like this. I'll just read it to you. Page two. Or the other side of the first page, if it's got a two at the top there. Zevulun lechof yamim. And it talks about Zevulun, the blessing of Zevulun, before the blessing of Yisachar. So the rabbis ask, Kodam Zevulun Yisachar. Zevulun comes before Yisachar. Why? V'lama. Why? She Zevulun oseik b'prachmatia. Zevulun is busy with business. Zevulun was on the coast. They lived probably nowadays, I don't know what you would call it, Tel Aviv, Netanya. You know, they had a nice part of the country there, but they were fishermen. And Yisachar oseik b'Torah. The tribe of Yisachar was famous. They would study Torah. So how did what was the deal? Asu shutafut b'neim. They made a partnership. And what did they say? She pragmatia shel Zevulun li Yisachar, that the business, that doing the business that Yisachar would do, they would support Zevulun in their studies. Shekein Moshe Bircha, Moses gave them a bracha, Samach Zevulun B'tzeisecha, Zevulun should be rejoiced when you go out, in other words, when you go on your work, V'yisacha Bo'alecha and Yisacha in your tents, the tents of Torah. Samach Zevulun B'tzeisecha L'Prakmatia, be happy when you go to business, Zevulun Mishum T'yisacha Bo'alecha Osek B'Torah, that Yisacha can study Torah. Right? The whole idea of supporting institutions as the way we do to this very day. And if we're lucky to be Yisachar and to be in that position, fine. But the Zevulans are also incredibly important. Lama Eitzchayim hi l'machazikim ba, and the whole idea is that the Zevulun becomes the support, the machazik, the keeps the Torah going. Leficha hikdim Zevulun. That's why Zevulun comes first, before Yisachar. Without the Zevulun, Yisachar cannot study. Wow, you can't say it clearer than that. And the Gemara here is so interesting. I know of a case now of a family where they've made an arrangement. Somebody's learning, I think, in Lakewood, and being supported by the family as a Yisachar-Zevulun relationship. Very unique. Doesn't happen very much today. But essentially, we're all kind of Zevuluns. As soon as that guy comes to the door or comes to the shul and wants to collect for the yeshiva, you know, we all become a bit of Zevulans. But the interesting thing, I remember being told this years ago, is that the Zevulun has no excuse to start not to study. Right? You might say, well, I give money to the yeshiva, and therefore I give the check every year. That makes me patur, I'm exempt from studying. No. Zevulun is not allowed to be ignorant. He may not study kolayom, but, you know, I always like the Eastern European concept when you read about what used to go on in Eastern Europe before the war. The day began, sort of 5 o'clock or whatever, and they would have a shiur for an hour and a half in the morning. Daven, they would then go to work and come back, and they would go back to shul, and they would study for another 2 hours. The favorite sefer used to study something called Ein Yaakov, which is all the stories of Talmud, and this became very popular in Eastern Europe. And that was the day. And that was the average Jew would study 3-4 hours. Rambam sort of writes about, you know, the average time for study every day. It's mind-blowing. And it really is something very, very special that, you know, we, even for the Zevulans, those who are engaged in other pursuits during the day, there is still a time to study. The next quotation, again, I'm just going through some of the quotations because they're so interesting. The next quotation is talking about what the Kohen Gadol, the second quotation on the page, what he would say when he came out of the Holy of Holies. You would think to yourself, at that moment on Yom Kippur, what is he interested in? In some sort of spiritual elevation of the community. He's been uplifted, he's seen the glory of Hashem. I don't know how you're going to describe it. And the Gemara says, "Disnan hayim mitpalel tefila kitzara bebeit achitzon, my matzleh." What did the Kohen Gadol pray? Rabin ba'ada v'rabba ba'ada, two brothers presumably said, "Domre Travayu, mishmei de Rab Yehuda, yehi ratzon. May build your will, mithnecha Hashem elokeinu, shetei ashana hazog shumag shchuna." There'll be a good year. It'll be a year where we'll have plenty of rain, plenty of produce. In other words, business will be good. That's on the Kohen's mind when he's coming out of the Holy of Holies. Interesting. So again, the focus on business and sort of, you know, sort of making sure that that you pray for the Zevulun of in Eretz Yisrael. The next quote from the Rambam is famous because again the whole idea, as we used to say in yeshiva, you know, sort of the four letter word is the word you don't want to mention, the word work. And nowadays this idea of the learner earner and the earner learner, I always get it the wrong way around usually. When I'm talking to the students at Stern, you know, your first question, you talk about Shidduchim, what are you interested in? Earner, learner. Well, you know, that's what seems to be the language of the day. So listen to this. We always think about, you know, the learner, the guy who's learning Kol Hayom, and it's a great madrega. No, here we're talking about some pretty heavy hitters, the rabbis of the Talmud. Rambam says, and it's Rambam Hichot Talmud Torah, the third Hebrew quotation. Gedolei Chachmei Yisrael, the great sages of Israel, hoy mehem chotvei etzim, they used to chop wood, they were menial laborers. Umehen shovei mayim, schlep the water, which again is very menial, very heavy work. Mehem sumim, some of them would do things with, I don't know, sort of make things with some, maybe to do with drugs or whatever, not drugs in the negative sense, you know, like medicines or whatever. They still managed to study at the same time, and they indulged in Torah, but their focus also was on earning a livelihood. That is a clear indication from the Gemara. And of course, I just brought here the very famous stories, Chofetz Chaim. I was very fortunate because in London, there was a dayan of the one of the Batei Din who was a Talmud of the Chofetz Chaim. And he studied in Radin. He was 12, no, I think he was 13 when he went there. And it was interesting to talk to him because he remembered the Chofetz Chaim, remembered the rabbi so clearly. If you want to see an amazing film, there is something on YouTube which they found a film of the Aguda Convention 1923, which was held in Vienna. And all the great rabbis of that generation were coming into the convention and they have a film of the Chofetz Chaim coming in. Very short man, he used to wear this Polish cap, the very distinct hat, didn't wear, it was black, but it wasn't one of the sort of hats that you see today. And it, very interesting, you know, he wasn't a youngster at that time. He must have been in his 80s. He died in 1933. This is 10 years before he died, so he must have been mid-80s. And again, just interesting to see the man and to see the, you know, sort of a real representation of him like that. And the stories were legendary. He had a store, he had a, I don't know how you describe, probably a hole in the wall, in a place called Radin. If you've ever been to Radin, you've ever been to Poland, you'll know these stores were really tiny. I mean, this is not the sort of store that even, you know, anything sort of what we call in Israel, makolet, is massive compared to what this was like. But the reality of it is that in Radin, the story is that he one day decided he wasn't going to be going to Rabbonus. He had, I think he had 2 days as a community rabbi. On the first day, he said to his community when he was appointed that I will only stay if you all agree to my decisions. Day two, they had a din Torah and two people came in. One person said, I agree with the rabbi. The next person said, I don't agree with the rabbi. They went out arguing and the Chofetz Chaim said, I resign. That's it. I'm not carrying on. You're not agreeing to my decision. That's it. Finished. And that was the end of his rabbinical career. Unbelievable. And for the next 85 years or so, or 80 years after that, he spent his time in other pursuits, as we know today, sort of writing books and whatever. But he did have a store. In fact, what happened was his wife used to run it, and he used to sit at the back, and he was studying. It seems to have been an arrangement. But what happened was that the store became very popular, because Chofetz Chaim, you know, this is something, the Rebbe's got a store, we've got to go and buy. And he was worried. And why was he worried? Because he was outdoing the other guy in town, because the other guy also had a store, whatever his name was, and he was losing money. So the Chofetz Chaim got to the point, that, I mean, nobody thinks like that. Chofetz Chaim got to the point, he said, I can't keep this store open because the other guy is losing so much money, I've got to shut my store. Right? I'd rather sort of go bankrupt, let the other guy survive, than take away the parnosa from another Jew. Unbelievable. And there's even a more apocryphal story, and I don't know if it's true, that somebody came in, a Jewish guy came in, and unfortunately stole something from the store, and the Chofetz Chaim ran after him when he saw him leaving the store, and he said, I'm Moichel, I forgive you, I forgive you. And everybody said, what do you mean forgive you? Go to the police. Call the police. He said, I can't bear the thought of another Jew having this sin on him, on my conscience. He just couldn't handle it. So of course, what happened in the end, they closed the store. How are you going to keep a store open with people running a store like that? It's just impossible. But these standards are so above and beyond. I mentioned here also Pinchas Kahati. Pinchas Kahati's son-in-law was my Rosh Yeshiva in Israel. Uri Cohen, who's still, thank God, is still going strong in Mevaseret Zion. Pinchas Kahati was a bank teller. And what happened was that while he was working in the bank, he used to give a shiur at lunchtime. And the shiur was on Mishnah. He used to start, he started with brachas and he worked his way through. And people started, you know, sort of hearing about this shiur. And they said to him, write it up. Every shiur that you give, every commentary. You now got Kahati on the Mishnah. It's the most fantastic commentary on the Mishnah. That it's a stand, it's a classic. Translation to English and probably to other languages. Phenomenal. And again, this all came out of someone who was, you know, in his spare time, his main job was working in the bank. That's what he did. So again, you see from all of this that the actual indulging in business is not something which the rabbis refrain from. On the contrary, they saw it as an opportunity to elevate, to spiritually uplift, and in certain cases to support, to be in a position where you can not only support yourself, but support others. The case is made and it's very clear. So what this whole issue today is about people who argue that they can't go to work, I just do not understand. I feel very sad. Bnei Brak and Yerushalayim, the two poorest towns in Israel. And it's mainly because most of the population there are not working. And there's something, the picture is changing very slowly. There are people trying to sort of do something about it, but it's a very slow change. It's not an easy change to make. What I did go into here, which I may not sort of spend too much time on, some of the everyday cases. The old days in Israel, you used to have to use a telephone, a real telephone. Nowadays, everybody's on a cell phone. So I always was reminded of this story that you used to go into a phone booth and you would call Chutz La'aretz, those who lived in Israel, maybe in the 70s and 80s, remember this. You could never make a phone call. It took you 2 hours to make a phone call. So the way that you would try and do it is get through to the person at the other end to call you back. But the way you would do that is by asking for a collect call, and then the person at the other end would know to reject the call. And of course, you're using the telephone company as a means of getting hold of somebody else. Is it allowed or is it not? This is a very Jewish, you know, this is the way the Jews thought about it. In those, nowadays, of course, everybody laughs because everyone's got three cell phones in Israel the whole time. Sorry?
Is that really like
It's a question mark. It's not ethical, and we can get into a whole discussion about it. And there's a lot of takeaway from this shiur. It's now not such an issue because we don't. Who can use a telephone these days?
Where can you find
a telephone? Correct. But it's interesting what I saw here, and that the definition of stealing is not just taking something that doesn't belong to you, but it's more to the point if the other person is particular. Would the phone company be particular about it? The answer is yeah, I guess they would. The fourth case is my favorite, taking hotel towels. Right? Some people feel that they have to. And the story I wrote here about Kirk Douglas, which is wonderful. Kirk Douglas went to Israel for the first time in the late 1990s, I think. He's become more connected. He's going to be 100 years old, Kirk Douglas. Unbelievable. And he's become more connected to Jewishness over the years through Eish HaTorah and whatever. And he went to stayed in the King David Hotel. And he walked in and he was asked by reporters at the time, what was the most impressive thing about Israel? And he said, this hotel was wonderful. He said, why? Because they all know the King David is wonderful, but why was it so wonderful? He said, because they even got the monogram on my towel and on my towel. My initials are on it. KD. It was wonderful. Oh, good. He joked about it, but it was a really funny story. Again, are you allowed to take those particular items? The answer is clearly not. I don't know why you would want to take them, but for people who maybe want to have a souvenir, totally take the soap, and people take... my father-in-law went all over the world, so he said, just to remind him where he'd been, he always had these little soaps which he collected, but never did very much with them. But, that is expected. But to take anything more than that... Sorry? They're meant to be taken. So again, all of this is very subjective, in terms of how you apply it. Again, I don't want to get into the whole discussion of Yiyush and all the halakhic implications. There's a lot to say about this. What is interesting in the next comment, which I think is important, is the idea of the fact that as far as we are concerned, we don't have big claims and small claims. For us, a claim of a pruta, as the Gemara says, a small amount is treated the same as a claim of a large amount. And that's really important. That's something that Judaism says, that when it comes to involvement with other people's money, especially if you're going to go to a din Torah, we have to treat people, in an equal way. We don't have this sense of favoritism or anything like that. It's absolutely forbidden. Even to the point where you've got here, an interesting thing about the thief, just something that I brought as a point of information, that there's two words in Hebrew for a thief, a ganav and a gazlan, words that you may have come across. Ganav is someone who steals at nighttime, and the gazlan steals during the daytime, daylight robbery. And in fact, the Gemara says the ganav is worse. You'll say to me, well, daylight robbery is much worse than a thief at nighttime, a burglar. So they say no, because the thief at nighttime, when he comes in, he's coming in under the cover of dark. So what does he show? He's afraid of man. All right? Not afraid of God. He's thieving. But he's afraid of man. During the day, he has no fear of man, no fear of God. So the Gemara says that someone who has this fear of man and not a fear of God is worse than someone who has no fear of anybody. How does that work out? It works out that for instance, the gunner pays twice. He has a fine of what is called kefal. He pays double, steals 100, he's got to pay back 200. And if he slaughters the animal, he pays back 400, sometimes 500. He's got a much heavier thing because his denial of awareness of God is much, rather the denial of the awareness of man, the fear of man, of the ganav, is something where it's more extreme. He fears man, he doesn't fear God at the same time. The gazlan, the daylight robber, doesn't fear anybody. Doesn't fear God, doesn't fear man. He's not considered to be as severe. Interesting logic that the rabbis had. a borrowing. Again, I just brought in some examples over here because I think that they're very interesting, but I want to get to the end. Because what I want to sort of come to the conclusion here is what I started with. In the end of the day, obviously what I'm trying to show you from the sources and from what we've been discussing is that business ethics and the behavior in business is really important. It's something which is seen by in so many different places as something which is encouraged, the arrangements of Tzachos Zevulun and all the rest of it. And also in terms of actual sort of where you conduct yourself, how you conduct yourself in business is something which is extremely important. There are, I always like to ask fellow colleagues, rabbis, you know, how many shilas do you get in Choshen Mishpat? Usually the answer is zero. May have had one in their lives, and you know, it's not a thing that we're used to studying. We should know that it's a quarter of Shulchan Aruch. You know, we're very into sort of Chagim, and we're into Shabbat, and we're into even kosher and what's not kosher. But the section dealing with business and with that type of area of our lives is not studied, certainly not on a regular basis. And it's important to know what to do and what not to do. So that's a sort of a pitch on that. But the fourth page, which I really wanted to go through with you, is this question of Kiddush Hashem. I mentioned it before, the idea that business behavior is an absolute opportunity to make a Kiddush Hashem, to make the name of God a bit holier in the world. And this story is so famous, but I wanted to read it with you. It's Talmud Yerushalmi, Bava Metzia, page 8. Now listen to this, and it's fabulous. Shimon ben Shetach, Have Asik Bahada Kitna. Why it was that Shimon ben Shetach was involved in a certain business deal with some sort of flax. And Armilei Talmidoi, Rebbe Arpi Minach Vanan Zabdin Loch. So they said, Rebbe, you know, don't you deal with it, we'll sell it for you. Fine. Chada Chamov Let Ad Loi Sugin. Basically, what they decided to do was they were going to go and buy an animal, I suppose, to schlep the flax or whatever. They went to buy a donkey or some sort of animal to carry the stuff. And what happened? And they went to a non-Jew and they bought a chamar, a chamor. They bought a donkey. Around the neck of the animal was a diamond. And of course, what the non-Jewish guy had done is that he saw that was a safe way of protecting the diamond. So he left it there and he forgot all about it, like the $98,000 in the desk, right? Similar story. And what happened? Atun Lagabe, so they brought the animal back to Shimon ben Shetach, the great rabbi. Amrin le man kadun let atzarich la'etuv. In other words, do you have to return it or not? Amalon, so he said to them, Lama Amrin le zabnina lachad chamar mechad sirkoi. What are you saying? We bought an animal from this man, Vitali Bechada Margale, and there's this diamond around its neck, or a pearl, or whatever it was. Amalon v'yeda b'mara Amrin le lo. And he asked them, does the master know that it's gone? And they said, no. So Amalon, he said to them, Lon Ezel Chazar, go and return it. There's no discussion in the mind of Shimon ben Shetach whether he should, whether he shouldn't. He's immediately giving the item back. There's not even a hesitation in his mind. And of course, this leads to the famous Gemara, which I think we all know, but we have to hear it again from time to time. When the Gemara says like this, and this is the crescendo of the whole shir, it says like this, V'yehe masa'o matano benachat. When you deal with people, deal with them softly, with kind words. Be pleasant to deal with. What do people say when a person deals with them, let's say in business dealing? And you're a nice person to deal with. Okay, you strike a bargain, you strike a deal, but you behave in a menschlich way. What do they say? Ashrei aviv shelim do Torah. Yeah, you're a religious man. Thank the Lord that your father taught you what he taught you. Ashrei Rabo Shalindata, happy is the Rebbe, your teacher, must be very proud of you that you do all of this. Oy lahem lebriot shalom du Torah, woe to the people, don't study this code of ethics, this code of law, because you know you can see that the world around you maybe doesn't behave like this. Ploni Shalindo Torah Ra'u Kama Geim Derecham, look at this man, see how proud and correct his path is. Come on, to Kanim, and somehow how his actions are so put together, as they say. Alav HaKetuv Omer, the verse says about him, Vayomer li Avdi Ata, that this is a true servant of God, Avdi Ata Yisrael, you are the servants of God, O Israel, Asher Becha Et Pa'er, I will be glorified through you. It's beautiful. Aval mi shekarei b'shoneh, you can have the most religious person and he spends all his time with the rabbis and with the rebbes and who knows what. But he doesn't behave well in business. The 11 o'clock news, I hated watching 11 o'clock news. Always they had this story, I think it was Channel 11 in New York, New Jersey, where it would have a landlord in Brooklyn. It always gave me the shivers when I heard the word Brooklyn and landlord go together. And it was either that or it was Williamsburg, maybe even worse. And they would say that they would show you a picture of the apartment. The apartment's falling down. There's water running down the walls. Horrible. And then they said that we tried to interview the landlord and he didn't want to say a thing. What do you see? You see the camera. You see a very round, strange hat put in front of the camera. And you know, as a Jew, you know what it is. You know who the guy is. And it was just unbelievable that this would repeat itself, unfortunately, and many, many times. And it's just sad to me. It's just so difficult, depressing that people who, you know, sort of put out this kind of religious image to the whole world, but don't realize what a responsibility it is when you wear the clothing. As they say, you walk the walk, you got to talk the talk. And it's just a challenge. And I think this is something that, I wish more Rabbein would say this, but at least, you know, I'm happy to say it in this forum this evening. So listen to this. Again, four lines from the bottom. Kore shonim, mishamish tamicham. You've got somebody who is very close to rabbis. But he's not honest in business. He doesn't speak nicely. You know, he's very coarse or whatever the word is. What do people say? Woe to him who studied Torah, because look what it produces. Woe to his father. What a waste of the tuition, as they say. And the Rebbe should also wasted his time. Look what happened there. People will judge him. They'll say how bad he studied Torah. Look what it produced. Such a negative behavior. Kama mucha'orin derachav. How bad are his ways. How disgusting he is. Alav HaKatav Omer. Ne be'emor lehem am Hashem eile me'artza yatzav. This is one of the reasons we left Eretz Yisrael, according to the Gemara. So it's really quite desperate. The bottom line of what we're saying essentially is two things. Number one, what I'm stressing here, the idea of Kiddush Hashem, because I think it's so important. It's such a great opportunity. As I said, people like Reichman, who I remember so clearly from what I saw in England, and various other people around. There's a wonderful man in the 70s and 80s called Tenenbaum, Joseph Tenenbaum, also from Canada. There's a lovely story that whole family was not religious. None of them stayed religious. And he was giving a lot of money to yeshivot in Yerushalayim, particularly. And he insisted on just one thing, that it would be known as the Tenenbaum campus. So wherever you went, whichever yeshiva it was, in those days, there was always the Tenenbaum campus. And then somebody asked him once, and he said, Mr. Tenenbaum, why do you insist on putting your name in every place like this? You know, are you on an ego trip? He said, no. He said, God forbid. He said he wants his grandson one day, his great-grandchild, who may not even know, comes to Jerusalem, sees the name on the building, and will go in and find out what it is. Right? If he sees his name on a building, on a yeshiva, maybe his great-grandson or his grandchild will walk in there, and who knows, maybe they'll become connected to Torah. That was his comment. I thought that was really special. So again, these are very unique individuals, sort of philanthropists and others, who understand and, you know, do what they have to do in the correct way. The Kiddush Hashem aspect of this, I think, is extremely important. And then the other thing, which I said right at the beginning, is also the fact that, you know, the reality of understanding that being involved in business activity is not a negative, it's not a waste of your time. It's something which, on the contrary, the great rabbis of Israel did do it, and they understood the way that you prioritize, the way that you come to sort of a conclusion about this, how to do this in a fair and proper way. I always remember, and I quote my rabbi from London, Rabbi David Cooper, Zichron Livrocha, a very wonderful man, student of Rabbi Dessler and Rabbi Dina Bromsky. He really was close to the very sort of serious rabbis who were around in the 40s and 50s in England. And he said to me, I asked him once, Reb Dovid, what was the definition of a really special person in Eastern Europe? Right before the war, what did they say? And he said to me something which I never forgot. He said, the greatest accolade was not to be called a frum Jew. Frum Jew, the word frum was the word they used for the galach, for the priest. Frum, meaning religious. They didn't like that word because it had a connotation of something to do in Christianity. He said what they would call a person, the greatest accolade in Eastern Europe, was to call somebody an Elah Chayid, an honest Jew. That was the bottom line. He said if you got that title, right, what we used to call jokingly the EY, you became EY, Elah Chayid, then you were in good shape. And it's just one of those things that we should be made aware of. I hope that this kind of generates a bit of interest, certainly to look at more of the information that we've been studying, because as you can see, there's a lot more to talk about here. But in general, to remember this idea that you know, it's not sort of incidental to be honest, not incidental to make the Kiddush Hashem. It's part of what we should be doing as a nation in the world. And I can only say thank God that many, many Jews do this. And, you know, I hope many, many more will sort of be inspired, hopefully, to sort of be connected to these ideals, which are real, really high ideals. Finish with a thought for the day from the Tziv of Volozhin, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and he says something really quite amazing. He says, Amalek is mentioned twice in the Torah. Amalek is mentioned in beginning in B'Shalach, when the Jews come out of Mitzrayim, and he's mentioned at the end, when we read Parshat Amalek on Shabbat before Purim. And he says, in those two mentionings of Amalek, the previous section, one is where the Jews have in Shemot, they have a problem of faith. And the other section, he says, in the Parsha Ki Tetze, is where they have a discussion about weights and measures. So the Tziv says, you know what, I'm going to put two and two together. Weights and measures, honesty in business, is really a statement of faith. If a person believes truly that this is all by the act of God, the hand of God, the Yad Hashem, Hashgacha Pratit, everything is in its place and God is there, providing whatever you need, then your business will be honest. But and if not, Chas V'Shalom, if you have questions of faith, and then your honesty in business gets compromised, what comes out of that? Lo aleinu, God forbid, Amalek. And it's something for us to think about, it's something for us to be aware of, and I believe something to contemplate. But as I said, you know, there's a lot more to say here. This is a subject which I think goes really to the heart of who we are as Jews. I would hope. For next week, just to mention, we're going to talk about Christianity, something completely different. And I know Rabbi Gluckstein was a bit worried about talking about Christianity, you told me. We're not going to sort of make too many rash comments. We're talking about, essentially, there's a problem on the campuses, which is still there. I see them around Columbia from time to time. The whole problem of Jews for Jesus and sort of encouraging particularly sort of vulnerable Jewish kids to get involved with that whole negative group of people, and not just negative, but they're actually, it's wrong what they're doing. And I think for us it's just important to maybe understand where Christianity and Judaism sort of hold in terms of religious dogma and tradition, etc. And that's going to be next week. But for this week, I think the takeaway here is clearly the idea, let's all make that Kiddush Hashem just a little bit bigger in the way we speak to people, in the way we talk to people, and particularly in the way that we conduct ourselves in business. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.